Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During oral arguments yesterday in the Supreme Court, the six conservative justices, three of whom were seated during the Trump administration, appeared comfortable with further restricting abortion rights in the United States. The case is Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which has pitted abortion rights proponents against a Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks, and that is well before viability. The actual decision isn't expected until the summer, but the political ramifications already are rippling across the country, especially in states, including Ohio, where GOP-led legislatures are poised to enact similar bans. Liberal Justice Elena Kagan expressed concern during the arguments about the institutional credibility of the nation's highest court, given that passage of the law was predicated on the three new members being seated.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
We're talking politics today with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us each month to cover national political news. Welcome back, Ken Rudin.
Good morning, Ann.
Former President Trump made no secret that he was looking for justices that were against abortion rights. The authors of the Mississippi law at issue made no secret that they were testing the court after the Trump appointments of Associate Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch. Is Kagan right?
Well, as far as the stench on the Supreme Court, it depends on what side you're on. If you believe that the Roe decision in 1973 was wrongly decided, if you feel that abortion is a terrible thing that the government should not have been accepting back in 1973, then there is no stench. But if you believe Justice Kagan does, that getting rid of abortion and what it's doing to the choice of millions and millions of American women, it will be a political stench that could last for a long, long time. And of course, could very well be a key political issue in next year's midterm elections.
Yeah, the coverage this morning was pretty similar across the board. Bad news for abortion rights proponents, good news for abortion rights opponents. With all those headlines, I mean, I maybe I missed something out there, but with all of that, what does it do to the atmosphere right now?
Well, it's, you know, we can't say that we haven't been fighting over abortion since the 73 decision. Mm-hmm. In 1980, the Republican convention was torn between pro-choice Republicans and anti-choice Republicans with the Reagan nomination and election. So we've been arguing about this for the longest time, but there was never any serious doubt. There was never considered to be any serious doubt that the Roe decision would be curtailed, if not overturned completely, until Trump, as you point out, named three pro-life, anti-abortion justices to the Supreme Court, including here I go again on this thing, but the fact that when Justice Scalia died and President Obama tried to nominate a choice of Merrick Garland to succeed him in the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell blocked that. But of course, once there was a Supreme Court openings under the Trump administration, Mitch McConnell allowed those three, including Amy Coney Barrett, to get on the court with very little time to go before the election. So everything has been about politics. Everything has been about who controls the Senate, which is so crucial. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are right now. We've talked about this for the longest time, but here it is right in front of us. It seems like, as you point out, listening to the justices yesterday and their argument and listening to their questions about the Mississippi law, not only do they seem very likely to approve and accept the Mississippi law that basically forbids abortion after 15 weeks, but it looks like they're going to take down the Roe decision altogether, and mm-hmm. that would affect many states around the country.
All right, so let's talk about the politics of that, because I'm wondering about the implications of Republicans as we head into the midterms and control of the Senate and House hang in the balance, and Democrats as well. What are your thoughts about how they play this?
Well, and of course, it all depends on where we're talking about. If mm-hmm. we're talking about in liberal blue states, California, New York, states like that, Illinois, then, of course, the decision by the Supreme Court to curtail or perhaps end Roe would be seen as, you know, very negatively. And the Democrats, or at least the pro-choice Democrats, would be able to take advantage. But, you know, for all we talk about Ohio, two terms in a row, two elections in a row, Donald Trump carried the state by 8 percentage points. Opposition to abortion is a popular position in Ohio. Certainly the presidential race seemed to indicate that. And it may not be, it may be good news for whatever Republican, survives a Republican primary for that open Senate seat.
You know, when it comes to this kind of an issue in politics, Ken Rudin, which side, the losing side, hypothetic, I guess the people who support abortion rights versus the winning, presumptive winning side in all of this, the people who oppose abortion rights, who's more outraged, who's driven to the polls? Does the outrage or does the what drives people to the polls in these kind of cases?
That's a great question. I mean, studies have shown all these years that those opposed to abortion rights seem to be more motivated to go to the polls on that issue than the so-called pro-choice voters. But if women across the country are so outraged by what's happening with this court, if they're so angry at this so-called Republican court and, you know, what Donald Trump has left us in the Supreme Court, his legacy on the Supreme Court, they may come out in droves. You heard Corbett Coleman on the newscast talk about Stacey Abrams running for governor of Georgia. I mean, these people may be just angry and African-Americans and women and pro-choice voters, they could find themselves, their rights being under siege, and then suddenly say, you know, we're not going to take this anymore. We're going to get out and vote. But, you know, this is the first time we've come to this decision in the 45 years we've been talking about abortion rights. This is the first time in our history that those rights are in jeopardy. And we've never come across anything like this before, so we don't know how the voters will respond in November of 22 and 24.
An anti-abortion arm of the Democratic Party has been gaining some steam, and I don't know if that's just because they're filling up my mailbox with stuff or what. I know I have seen more about them. This is a splint, you know, this is an arm of the Democratic Party that doesn't get a lot of attention, but seems to be gaining some traction.
Well, there's truth to that. I remember Mary Rose Okar, who years ago was a member of Congress from Ohio, a very liberal Democrat, but she was pro-life. She was opposed to abortion rights. It could be because of Catholic faith, whatever it is, they opposed it. And there are, you know, there were pro, believe it or not, Roger Stone. I can't believe I'm talking about Roger Stone. Roger Stone's ex-wife, former wife, Ann Stone, was for the longest time the chairperson of Republicans for Choice. I mean, there are pro-choice Republicans and there are anti-choice Democrats. It's not as monolithic as some people would think, but for the most part, the Democratic Party stands for women's right to choose. The Republican Party opposes that.
So maybe this goes to what you just said, but I wanted to talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, as long as I've been covering national and state politics, Republicans have been chipping away at abortion rights. It's about 30 years, I guess, since the landmark Planned Parenthood v. Casey case. That's when they overturned the trimester framework of Roe in favor of the viability analysis and allowing states to implement abortion restrictions. You know, which is what I was very familiar with back in the olden days. So,
but ultimately, if you base your assumptions on the fact that Roe is going to be gone, if the Mississippi and perhaps the Texas laws are allowed to stay in the place, it won't end abortion. It just will end it in the states where the Republican legislatures decide they don't want it. But there are states, unfortunately, some women will have to drive hundreds and hundreds of miles to get an abortion, but there are some states, like right now, you know, the Texas law forbids abortion after, what, I think 6 weeks, and many women are driving to Arizona or Oklahoma or somewhere to get abortion. So it won't be gone for everywhere, but it will be more difficult by far to receive a legal abortion in this country.
Right. When I was a little kid, you went to New York State from Michigan. You know, that's what people did. But that was people
and
with
so
means.
Many women died. I mean, so mm-hmm. many women
then
died.
Then there's illegal
were,
abortions,
it
right.
It was illegal. They were botched abortions. And you know, you there's always that famous ugly meme of a wire hanger that mm-hmm. has been put out, you know, on social media, reminding people what it was like back in the day when it was not legal and so many women paid the price with their lives.
How much do you think this is going to be an issue on the campaign trail? Like, I suppose we could even talk about the primary trail because we've got that big primary pool of candidates for the U.S. Senate, Republican primary for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Rob Portman. Do you think in those kind of races, at least at the primary level, it's going to be an issue? Or what about in the general election?
Well, but both are true. I mean, obviously, not only are Republicans, especially in the Republican primary for the Portman seat, not only are these Republicans trying to outdo the other with fealty to Donald Trump, but, you know, they're all pro-life. They're all anti. I keep saying pro-life, and I know a lot of people don't like that term. It's really a shorthand term. You know, I grew up in this Twitter world where you don't have that many letters. But I mean, obviously, it's more complex than pro-life and pro-choice. But having said that, the Republicans certainly in the Ohio Senate race and races all around the country, the governorship of, matter of fact, I mean, perfect example in Texas, Governor Phil Abbott, who signed that very restrictive abortion law, is being challenged in the Republican primary by Alan West, the former congressman from Florida. Alan West is challenging Abbott for renomination as governor of Texas because he says Abbott is not conservative enough. So the Republican Party has gone from, you know, the Voineviches and the Portmans and the somewhat moderate conservatives to right wingers who have just, you know, following Trump's lead and following the ultra conservative wing of the party to such extents that the party is not even recognizable anymore.
Justice Barrett in the argument yesterday focused on the issue of adoption and how that could solve the problem of women who choose abortion because they can't afford to rear a child. She said they could just have the baby and then get back to work. And I'm just wondering about the larger social, the climate for that conversation about women and women's rights in this country.
You know, it reminds me of the people who say, well, we shouldn't have gun law. We shouldn't have laws restricting guns, but we should have mental health laws because that'll solve all the problems. Bringing a baby to term is a very, I mean, I can't even imagine what decisions and what thought processes are made to bring to that decision. But for I mean, look, Amy Coney Barrett, God bless her. She has seven children. She's obviously not a believer in abortion.
She's
or anything
a pro
like
at
that.
Giving birth.
Exactly. That's not the, you know, that she's not the one who should be giving advice to women who are torn over that very traumatic decision.
Have you noticed all the women who are talking about their own abortions? It's proliferating now. And I'm wondering what you think that does to the political conversation about all of this.
Well, once upon a time, an abortion was something that was in secret, just like homosexuality was mm-hmm. a secret. You didn't discuss it. You didn't talk about it in the open. An abortion now is not something to be, well, it's firstly, it's nothing to be ashamed of, but it's also nothing to be secretive about because people need to know that this happens, that women are going through this process in the country despite more and more restrictive laws. And the more people realize that this is something that does go on in the country, they may realize that ending it the way the Supreme Court seems to be leaning could be very, very traumatic for so many millions of American women.
We're talking politics today with political journalist Ken Rudin. He's host of the Political Junkie podcast, and we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Ken going forward, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Congress is facing another end-of-year crunch over a stopgap spending bill that would keep the lights on in federal agencies. Just this morning, Democrats and Republicans struck a deal to extend funding into February that is expected to pass the House. Its fate in the Senate is less clear, thanks to a group of Senate Republicans who want to attach a measure to the bill that would bar enforcement of the Biden administration's vaccine mandates. All of this, of course, comes on the heels of the news that the new variant has hit the shores of the U.S. What's more, December 15 is the next deadline to raise the national debt ceiling or risk defaulting. Still with us, political journalist Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken, all right, so, you know, Republicans have used the threat of a government shutdown as leverage before, most notably back in 2013 when Ted Cruz, freshman senator then, forced a government shutdown in an attempt to prevent the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. So they've used this not very successfully, and that blew up in the GOP's face. What's your expectation here?
Well, then there was another shutdown. That both sides, you know, fight over who gets the blame. Look, you mentioned as you're coming back from the break, you say Ken Rudin is still with us. I'm wondering if the audience is still with us, because once they hear about a possible government shutdown, and they say this happens every time. First of all, they come to the cliff, they come to right at the edge of the cliff, and then suddenly somehow cooler heads prevail, and if there's not a shutdown, they manage to put off the spending for some kind of stopgap bill that extend the nonsense for another couple of months. This is just remarkable, and it just goes on and on and on. You see all these people who are not running for the Senate or not running for Congress or retiring from Congress, and you wonder, what's the point of going to Congress anymore? It once upon a time was a great honor, a great accomplishment to serve the American people and getting laws done, getting things passed. But that doesn't happen anymore because they have these political games. Both sides play it, but I'm not gonna bore you with both sides-ism right now, because it's clearly a Republican tactic that they threaten. Now, Mitch McConnell says, no, there's not going to be a shutdown. But there are other Republicans who have basically come to Congress to shut down government, to destroy government. They don't want to make government better. They're not, again, they're not Rob Portman, George Voinovich kind of Republican. Even Mike DeWine Republicans, who were when he was in the Senate, you know, they believed in getting things done. But now Jim Jordan and the Josh Hawleys and the Matt Gaetzes and the Marjorie Taylor Greens, they've just gone off the deep end in supporting things that don't make sense. Now, when it comes to the shutdown, I mean, basically, there's a good-sized Republican contingent in the Senate that really just opposes the Biden vaccine and testing mandate, you know, for large employers, and say this is unconstitutional and it's big government. Meanwhile, what's amazing about this, and I'm sorry I'm going on one of the Ken Rudin rants I always do on your show, but the Republican Party keeps saying Joe Biden is responsible for the new increase, the new variant, the new thing that's been found in the country, that more and more people are getting sick, more and more people are dying, while at the same time, the Republican Party is doing everything it can to stop Joe Biden from implementing mandates for vaccines and masks. So, I mean, maybe they think they can have it both ways. I don't think the American people can possibly be that stupid and not see what they're doing. Hmm. But
well,
they
George
are,
Orwell called it doublethink.
That's what it is. I mean, it's some of us kids call it bizarro world. I mean, because it's just what's down is up and what up is down, and whether it's a winning process, you know, a winning strategy for 2022, we'll find out. But right now, I mean, if I were betting money, and I'm not betting money, but if I were, I would say that the Republicans do pick up the House in 2022. And despite all these things, these proposals they're doing, and the Lauren Boberts and the Mary and the Matt Gaetzes and the Marjorie Taylor Greens, and you have somebody like Kevin McCarthy, who somehow fears that Liz Cheney is far more big of a threat than Paul Gosar, who put out a meme threatening the life of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, this is just madness. And I think of great Republicans in the past, like Bob Michael, the former Republican minority leader in the House from Illinois, who is a dear friend and who I respected tremendous. And he must be just rolling in his grave because watching what's happened to the Republican Party, even John Boehner, I mean, he said a lot of things in his book that I mean, he left out a lot of things too, but he's probably, no doubt, he's livid of what's happened to the party. I mean, there are some Democrats who couldn't stand John Boehner, but John Boehner believed in some kind of comity and some kind of decency in the party, and that's not what you're getting now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Charles in London, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Yes, the Republicans most likely will pick up the House because of a simple principle that Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi don't understand. You will either drive the news cycle or it will be driven against you after a...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility.
That got cut off. Sorry about that.
That was upsetting.
Yeah, Charles is an inmate in.
But Charles was making an important point. Yeah. The fact is, the Democratic Party, the Biden-Harris administration, is not driving the news. The fact is, I don't know what's in the infrastructure bill. I don't know what's in the big Build Back Better, Better Business Bureau, Bo Bielinski. I mean, I don't know what's in anything anymore because you don't have anybody going out and selling it. And the Republicans are out there selling it, selling what it's not. And the fact is that you don't have the kind of salesman. Obama didn't really have that with the Affordable Care Act in 2013. And he basically, 2010.
Yeah.
And the Republicans wound up winning 63 seats in the House because of it. So I just think that I think what the Biden administration is proposing is things that they will do good for the American people, and yet you'd never know it by the lack of salesmanship coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and that's tragic.
Earlier this fall, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed to a deal that raised the debt ceiling and avoided a default. We talked about it at the time. He said at the time, I think he said, that's it. I'm not doing this again. And here we are.
Well, he got tremendous blowback from Donald Trump about that. I mean, Donald Trump, who's already on the warpath against the 13 Republican House members who voted for the infrastructure bill. For God's sakes, they're being attacked for voting for infrastructure. I mean, that is beyond. But anyway, the fact is that Trump has been attacking the Republicans who voted for it. And once that happened, McConnell said, you know what? I'm staying out of this. I'm not going to be part of it. I'm not going to go through this again. And then you allow the nut job wing of the Republican Party to take control. And you know, in a 50-50, look, who controls the Senate, Chuck Schumer or Mitch McConnell? I would say Mitch McConnell, even though the Democrats nominally have the advantage. You know, when you have people like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin not, you know, doing everything they can to stay away from from the Democratic Party agenda, the Democrats are at odds, and Mitch McConnell has kept all his fellow Republicans in line.
You know, I think it's interesting when you bring up Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona. From what I've read, the Democrats are livid. The Democratic Party is livid. So I'm wondering, who is she trying to placate with the decisions she's making about how she conducts herself?
Well, you know, it almost reminds me of Tulsi Gabbard. This is a strange comparison, but Tulsi Gabbard was one of the most liberal members of the House. She was a congresswoman from Hawaii who ran for president, you know, didn't do too well in 2020, but she ran for president, was one of the most liberal left-wing members of the House. Where do you see Tulsi Gabbard now? Always on Fox News. Mm-hmm. She is always on Fox News, this liberal left-wing former congresswoman. Now Kyrsten Sinema, who was once upon a time a Green Party adherent and, you know, ostensibly a left-wing. And when she came to the Senate in, I guess, 2018, was it 2018? She's become this moderate who suddenly says, I'm not spending money that we can't afford. And Democrats are livid. They're talking about a primary challenge, which will happen, but she's not up until 2024. So she can do all she wants. She's doing a lot of fundraisers with corporate sponsors who oppose the Biden agenda. This it's very fascinating to watch. She marches to her own drum, and that's what we're going to see. And then we'll see what happens, because the Republicans are not really embracing her. I mean, they don't love her. They beat her. Sinema beat their candidate in 2018. So I don't think they love her, but certainly Democrats.
Well, that's why
her.
I don't understand their strategy. She beat their candidate. That's because Democrats turned out and voted for her. And I'm wondering, does she think the Democrats are going to turn out and vote for her, and that this time around / Republicans either?
Well, you know, 2024 is a long time away from now. It really is. I mean,
you're right.
And but I don't know what her strategy is. Maybe she doesn't run again. Maybe she becomes a Fox. No, I don't see her as a Fox person, because I think in her heart of hearts, she remains a Democrat. But one of those, I think one of her idols or one of the people she's following is really John McCain, who used to drive Republicans nuts because of his independence. Maybe she feels that she's the current incarnation of John McCain, and she's driving her fellow Democrats nuts.
And then, you know, you mentioned this, but House allies of former President Trump want to strip committee assignments from fellow Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill. And I'm thinking they don't have the final say on who gets to sit on committees, right? They're the minority. Or do
they? Well, that's true. I mean, that's absolutely true. And obviously, when Marjorie Taylor Greene was stripped of her committee assignments, it was Nancy Pelosi and the majority Democrats who voted for that. Of course, the Republicans voted against it. I think the only Republicans who voted for it were Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. But, you know, Kevin McCarthy stood up and said, this is disgraceful. It's the tyranny of the majority. You know, profiles in courage, it is not.
Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, the longest serving member of the Senate, announced a couple weeks ago that he would not run again. And who can blame him? He's 81 years old. He served in the Senate for nearly half a century. How much longer can he hang in there?
There's no reason to hang in there. First of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, he was elected in 1974 when Gerald Ford was president. I mean, that shows how long ago that was. And once you know something, what's amazing about Pat Leahy, and people forget this, when he was elected in 1974 in the Watergate year of 74, he was the first Democrat Vermont ever sent to the U.S. Senate. And now he's been there a gazillion years. I mean, it just shows how the politics of Vermont has changed. It was Eisenhower's best state in 1956, and now it's Bernie Sanders, you know, country. So Vermont has done a lot of changes. Leahy is, first of all, there's no question in anybody's mind that a Democrat, probably Congressman Peter Welch, who's a young spry chicken at 74, but Peter Welch will probably replace Pat Leahy, and the Democrats won't be jeopardizing a seat. But Leahy did was very effective in a lot of legislation over those past gazillion years.
You know, we talk a lot about, you know, there's Republicans, there's Democrats, and then there's this huge swath of independents in the U.S. As far as voters go. Does anyone have a sense about what's driving that growing independence and what way that leans?
Well, you know, all you have to do is pick up a newspaper and look at what's going on in Washington. And you always say, you know, curse on both your houses. Yeah. But I thought it was very interesting that independents seem to be going where the action is. And the reason I say that is because, like, for example, in Virginia last month, in the race for governor, independents overwhelmingly backed Glenn Youngkin, the Republican candidate, over Terry McAuliffe. Youngkin decided to portray himself as above the fray. He wasn't really a Donald Trump Republican, he said, because he didn't talk about Donald Trump, whereas Terry McAuliffe couldn't stop talking about President Trump at every opportunity, saying Youngkin and Trump are bound by the wrists, by the heels. So independents seem to be just going where the action is. I think a lot of independents went from Obama to Trump, as hard to imagine that is, because they're looking for answers. And if Obama wasn't, the Democrats weren't going to make it happen, then maybe we'll try the Republicans. And then when Republicans couldn't make it happen, all the independents went in 2018 for the Democrats. So I don't think they're stuck with, I don't think they're loyal to a party. I think they're loyal to getting things done, and they'll take their, you know, they'll, doesn't matter what party leads them to the promised land, as long as they're being led to it.
You know, there's often a lot, and well, we've talked a lot about how Democrats have a hard time forming, you know, a message, defending the infrastructure bill, for example, and that kind of thing. And we've talked about it before. We did when the Affordable Care Act was passed. It was like, where were they? Where were the billboards or whatever you want to call it? You know, the Republicans have their own issues, right? At the state party level, here in Ohio, there's a force to be reckoned with now. They are calling for an audit of the state Republican Party. Going back to Jane Timken's days as
chair
of the state party here. This is a more of a right wing, I guess, more of a even more conservative. I don't know ultimately, but I feel like the party's eating their own.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, look what's happening in the House. We saw the fact that it was Marjorie Taylor Greene. Let me see if I can get a little story. The story behind the story. Lauren Boebert, the QAnon type congresswoman from Colorado. Mm-hmm. She attacked Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and called her part of the Jihad Squad,
right,
as if she was a suicide bomber. And then Nancy Mace of South Carolina, who's a very conservative Republican, she's a freshman, she condemned Boebert for saying something. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene stood up and said that Nancy Mace is trash for condemning a fellow Republican. So basically they are eating their own, in the sense that if you don't back Donald Trump and Trumpism all the way, you are a traitor. I mean, whenever you see Donald Trump endorsing a candidate, and you're seeing more and more of that lately, you know, backing candidates and things like that, when he does, he always says, because they backed me in my fight against that illegal 2020 election. Everything about Donald Trump is me, 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 you know, as the opera singer would say. And basically the Republican Party either decides that that's the way to go if I want to survive in the party, or I'll stand up. But of course, the people who stand up may not be doing so well. Adam Kinzinger is going to be redistricted out of his seat next year. He won't be running again. Liz Cheney could very well lose her primary in Wyoming. There are going to be very few alternative voices in the Republican Party next year. And that is just shocking. I mean, just the thought of after Richard Nixon, Richard Nixon, who won 49 states in 1972. I mean, that's not what Donald Trump did. Richard Nixon won 49 states. Once he left office, nobody was willing to defend him or support him. And now there's a cult in the Republican Party that is so different than it was during those Nixon days, which many Republicans thought was the worst of the worst, the bottom of the bottom, but that was hardly worse than it is now.
My guest is political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And we'll be right back with more national politics. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci announced the first confirmed Omicron variant COVID-19 case in the U.S.
A recent case of COVID-19 among an individual in California was caused by the Omicron variant. The individual was a traveler who returned from South Africa on November the 22nd and tested positive on November the 29th. The individual is self-quarantining, and all close contacts have been contacted, and all close contacts thus far have tested negative.
Talking national politics with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken, the Delta variant made a rough summer and fall even worse for the Biden administration. And, you've already talked about this a little, but what is your expectation for Omicron going forward at this point?
Well, who knows? I mean, there's so many different stories, and I've been following the news as much as everybody has. And, you know, the question is whether, first of all, it is here. We knew it would be here. And the fact that it was discovered yesterday in San Francisco surprised no one. The real question is whether, one, how deadly it can be, and two, whether the booster or any of the existing shots can affect it or make it dangerous. So we don't know a lot of things, but not that this is a political issue, because it shouldn't be a political issue, but
and yet it
the
is.
But everything is political. Yeah. It just says, look, part of me is convinced that Donald Trump would have been reelected had there not been the COVID virus in 2019 and 2020. So it's not something Joe Biden would have liked. You know, he's still worried about with all the things that's going on, and high prices, and you know, gas and food, and all the things that's going on, but forget about politics. It's just not good news for the country. And it just seems like every time we think that, okay, we could finally take off our masks, like for example, in Washington D.C. about a week ago, they ruled that the mask mandate is over. You know, it's over. And then here comes the new variant, which could be, you know, terribly dangerous. And we're back to where we started. I think one of the reasons we saw so many people voting Republican in 2021 is that people are tired. Whether it's Biden's fault, the Democrats' fault or not, the fact is that we're wearing masks. Our relationships with people have changed, where our jobs are. We're still not going into work. We're still not socializing the way we used to. And it's exhausting. And sometimes you take it out on the party in power, and that's completely understandable.
The Lincoln Project was once the darling of the Trump resistance in the Republican Party, but that group's made several prominent missteps. The Tiki Torch stunt in Charlottesville, the sexual harassment allegations against co-founder John Weaver, also a former campaign advisor to John Kasich here in John McCain, and co-founder Rick Wilson recently has encouraged Trump to run again, despite the very real possibility that he could win. What's going on with that?
Well, once upon a time, and this is back in 2016, when there was a large contingent of never-Trump Republicans, the Lincoln Project came out and put out very clever anti-Trump commercials. They were clearly from a Republican point of view, from a conservative point of view, but they were mocking Trump, and they were very effective. That was cute. 2016, Donald Trump won, as many people may remember. Now, as you point out, this crazy thing they did by staging a fake white nationalist rally when Glenn Youngkin was appearing in Charlottesville, that backfired in his face. John Weaver, he's accused of sexually harassing quite a number of young men. And then there's some accusations that the Lincoln Project, members of the Lincoln Project, may have known about this and looked the other way. And now Rick Wilson, who's one of the continuing leaders of Lincoln Project, said, I hope Donald Trump runs in 2024 because he'll be easier to beat. That's exactly what Democrats said in 2016, mm-hmm. that I hope Donald Trump is mm-hmm. the one could be easy to beat. And let me remind you what those last 4 years were like. So they seem to be, if nothing else, irrelevant. I mean, there were Democrats who liked them because they were clever and they were sharp, but now I think they've worn out their welcome, and the money they've they've been receiving is way down from what it was in the past. And look, maybe their hearts are mean, maybe they mean well, but their strategy, their tactics are just, oh my God, stop this now. It was awful.
Former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has agreed to speak to the House January 6th committee. I can't remember if they subpoenaed him or if they just asked him, but so I don't know whether he had much of a choice. But what are you expecting out of that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, you saw that the subpoena was made against Steve Bannon, and it was again also the former Trump Attorney General, and who said he's not going to cooperate. I don't know. You know, I think that. I don't know if anything is going to come out of anything. You know, you look at what's going on with the trial in New York over financial issues. You look at the January 6th commission over the insurrection, what happened in the Capitol. And ultimately, I just don't know if anything is going to happen. You know, I mean, Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, all the people who clearly played a role in trying to bring down democracy, they were either pardoned by Trump or they're just avoiding everything. And basically, they're running out the clock. They're trying to run out the clock because once the, obviously this committee is not going to exist, this January 6th committee, congressional committee is not going to exist should the Republicans win control of the House in 2022. And maybe they're just, you know, avoiding, running out the clock, stalling. I mean, Trump, every time Trump is ordered to give up his tax returns or things like that, he does another appeal, hoping that, again, running out the clock. So I'm weary about this whole thing because it's as horrific as so many of the things they tried to do and did do. And the fact that nobody may pay the price for it, nobody may go to jail for it is just, you know, when people want to wonder why democracy is in jeopardy, this is one of the reasons that there's no attribution. There's no nobody pays the price of these kind of actions. And it's beyond disheartening and just awful.
Are you concerned about, you know, January 6th 2.0?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact is, I mean, very few people paid a price for January 6th. Everybody, when I'm hearing from people who are quoted from some of the right wingers saying that this was just a trial run. I mean, I kind of think that this was about the stolen election of 2020. I suspect that any election that in 2022 doesn't go the Republicans' way, they'll be protesting. They'll be, I mean, look what happened in Michigan. It wasn't only in January 6th. Mm-hmm. They tried to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. Mm-hmm. There were demonstrations in Michigan over, you know, they're still fighting the results in Georgia and Arizona and Michigan and other states. It doesn't stop. And there's no response to it. Like there's nobody. I mean, Joe Biden says, gee, I hope we have a voting rights bill soon, or I really think what they're doing is really bad. I don't know what the answer is, but right now I'm not getting a response from the Democrats that should warrant the danger that these people pose.
I think you mentioned her earlier. Stacey Abrams has announced she will run for governor in Georgia again. She lost very narrowly, and there were questions about the results of that election at the time, but she moved on and, in fact, you know, developed an incredibly complex and effective strategy to get out the vote in the next election. The next election was
2020.
Yeah, 20. Yeah.
I mean, thanks to her efforts, Joe Biden won Georgia, and right. In January of 2021, both Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won the two Democratic Senate seats that gave the Democrats control of the Senate. She's done amazing things and putting together voting rights issues and to the forefront, energizing the Black vote in Georgia, which has always been there for the taking, but they just never were inspired. And Stacey Abrams has done that. One thing it may have strengthened Brian Kemp's standing as governor with the Republicans. And the reason I say that is because Donald Trump hates Brian Kemp. He feels that Brian Kemp and the Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger were responsible for the stolen election in Georgia, and he blames Kemp for that, and he was going to support a challenge to Kemp. But if now Brian Kemp seems to be the strongest Republican to stand up to Stacey Abrams and defeat her once more, there are some conservatives who say, let him do it. Don't split the Republican Party and help Stacey Abrams.
You know, when I talk about it, I'm just thinking about she was bandied about as a possible running mate for.
She was on the short list. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously Kamala Harris, was the winner of that. Harris is not doing well right now. Her staff.
I don't know if she's not doing well. I don't know what she's doing. I mean, she's almost invisible.
Good point.
And then, believe it or not, I can't believe it, but I think CNN, was it Washington Post or CNN? But they basically said, okay, since Joe Biden is probably not running in 2024, is it going to be Kamala Harris? Is it going to be Pete Buttigieg? And I'm saying, are you kidding me? Are you really talking about 2024 now? But the fact is that, she's ambitious. Mm-hmm. She sought the presidency herself. Mm-hmm. One would think that she is the future of the Democratic Party post Joe Biden. But, let me see what she put on her resume in the past couple of months. I haven't seen much.
Mm-hmm. Pete Buttigieg there's a documentary out about him.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, sure. And he's a very attractive candidate. When I mean attractive, because a lot of voters liked what he had to say. He's a very good campaigner, and I think he has a long future in front of him. But right now, I think that what the Democrats should be focused on is not who replaces Joe Biden in 2024, but get their act together in 2022. Because, I mean, both right now with a 50-50 Senate and some vulnerable Democratic seats in the Senate coming up, including Arizona and Georgia and perhaps New Hampshire and Nevada as well. Forget about 2024, forget Pete Buttigieg. I mean, focus on the candidates who are running. Beto O'Rourke is running for governor of Texas. Mm-hmm. Stacey Abrams, as you pointed out, is running in Georgia. And of course, we can't forget Dr. Oz.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's
Dr.
right.
Oz is running for the Senate in Georgia as this is a so-called Dr. Oz who's running as a vaccine mandate opponent. We're back to where we started from. We haven't learned anything from 2020 mm-hmm. with 750,000 Americans dead, and we're still questioning whether shots should be mandatory or not. Right. It's just lunacy.
Yeah. Oz is running in Pennsylvania. He's an Ohio native, famously brought to the fore by Oprah Winfrey.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's a interesting stable that we will continue to talk about. Ken Rudin, we're running out of time right now. Thanks a lot for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Why do I always leave your show so depressed?
It's not me.
Okay. No, I love your show. I love the callers, and I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. So
thanks.
So thanks for keeping me on in spite of your bitter judgment.
Thanks for hanging in there. That is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.